And we are joined now in the studio by Jennifer Woofter. She's a Democrat, challenging Kathy Byron for the 22nd district seat in the House of Delegates. Jennifer, good morning. Welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be here.
So I guess first, a pretty standard start. Tell us a little about yourself and what made you decide you wanted to run for office.
Absolutely. Well, I am the daughter of a 41-year Navy veteran, so I grew up living around the world in a variety of different places. I met my husband when we were in Northern Virginia. We had some kids and decided Northern Virginia was not for us. So we...
That'll go over well down here, I have to say.
The traffic was killing us. The cost of living was killing us. And we both own our own businesses, which gave us a lot of flexibility to choose really anywhere in the country to live. We took 2 years looking everywhere around and ultimately decided that Lynchburg was the place for us. So we've been here now going on 6 years, and we could not be happier.
And one thing I note from your bio that is that It is of note, I guess, to us. You're a volunteer with CASA. We have them on the program several times a year. How did you like that experience of you're not representing the kids in court, but you're sort of looking out for them in court, I guess is a better way to put it.
That's exactly right. So the bigger context is I actually came to this because we were foster parents. In fact, we grew our family through adoption, through the foster care system, and became very familiar with the child welfare system in all of its complexities and frustrations and glories, all of that. And when our family was full, we decided we didn't want more kids in the house. I really wanted to stay involved because that's really close to my heart. And so I looked around and thought that CASA was a good fit. And so I've been doing that now for 2 years. And I will tell you, I've been involved in the community a lot, in a lot of different nonprofit organizations, getting involved in a lot of different capacities. But the work that I have done for CASA has been the most meaningful. It is the one where you look every day and you say, I am making a difference. And it's really important. If there's people listening who are interested in learning more, I so highly recommend it. There are kids in our community who are in really tough situations, who need an extra set of eyes on them, making sure that everybody is doing their job correctly. And one of the beautiful parts about being a CASA is that you're reporting directly to the judge in the case, being really able to say, what's going on with this kid? What do they need? What is the best outcome for them? It's an incredibly powerful and humbling experience to be a part of.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues that'll be confronting you as the campaign goes into the final months here. And on your website, and the website, by the way, is jenniferwoofterfordelegate.com. You talk about living wage jobs. Say we've got a lot of jobs in Virginia, very low unemployment rate. We need better jobs. And you talk about targeted investments. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by targeted investments? Is that something you want to see the government doing? Do you want to see them encouraging private businesses?
Yeah. So it's a little bit of all of it. We do have programs, a variety of programs already in place at the state legislature that are directing funding to help make it easier or to reduce the barriers to either starting new businesses or to growing existing businesses, or in some cases to attracting outside businesses into Virginia. I think where we sometimes miss the point is when we focus, you know, we put all of our eggs in one basket and we give $750 million in tax breaks to bring Amazon into Northern Virginia. That's great for Northern Virginia, but that does not necessarily benefit Virginia as a whole. I think what we need to be doing is really looking at what are the job needs across the Commonwealth, and particularly in our area, and making sure that we're investing and making sure that we're directing funds here. And if I can give a specific example, the wider sort of Lynchburg, Central Virginia area has a significant childcare desert problem going on. In some areas, the wait time to get qualified, licensed infant care is up to a year. We have individuals here in our community who are qualified, who are ready to launch childcare businesses, but it's expensive to get started. You need a building, it's highly regulated, there's a lot of upfront costs, and because most of the people who want to start those businesses are either women or people of color, who traditionally come to the bank with fewer assets in their pocket, they're not as attractive for a small business loan as other people might be. That's an area where just a little bit of bridge funding could go a huge way, not just to creating new jobs, good paying jobs for those childcare workers, but also really building our local entrepreneurial culture.
Well, and could you also see a solution there that maybe if you had, you know, fewer regulations on the business coming from the government to make it easier to start, less cost, would that be a good thing too? Or do you worry that in this is a business where you really want to have heavy regulation?
Well, childcare, I mean, I think every regulation that has been put in place is because something went wrong somewhere. I love those Facebook memes that go around every year explaining all of like the craziest laws and regulations in the world. The reality is every single one of those was because something went wrong somewhere. I think absolutely. Sometimes we do overregulate, and I think there is a role for examining those regulations, streamlining them. Sometimes they conflict. But I think in most places, especially in areas where our children are involved, we want lots of oversight.
Let's talk about gun control. Mm-hmm. One of the things you mentioned on your website is you're in favor of universal background checks, and people don't always mean the same thing with that. At the far end of it, for people in your party, there would be no transaction that would go without a background check. Do you propose that far, just commercial things? I mean, if someone wants to hand down firearm to a son or daughter, I mean, I know there are families like mine around here who have firearms in them that predate, you know, the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
How far would you go as far as background checks?
Yeah, so growing up in a military family, I grew up in a family with guns. I grew up living on military bases where there were firearms everywhere.
Yeah.
I absolutely respect the Second Amendment. I'm not here to take your guns. But I do think with that right comes great responsibility. When it comes to background checks, I think the devil's in the details. What we're not talking about at all is a registry of guns. The government doesn't need to know who owns guns, where they are, how many guns you have. That's not the issue. The issue is that responsible gun owners, when they transfer or sell their weapons, want to make sure that they're going into the right hands. And I think part of this is crafting a universal background check process that is easy to use, is not onerous, and allows us to just double check. So for example, being able to have a 1-800 number that you call with someone's name and social security number to just do an automated check of, are they on any sort of flagged list of people that shouldn't have guns? You go through the automated process. It takes 2 or 3 minutes. They give you a confirmation code that you write down to verify that you've gone through that process, and you're done. That's the sort of thing that I think we're talking about. And that's the sort of thing that is, yeah, I would say everybody. If you want to hand over your pre-Civil War firearm to your child, right, you're going to gift it onto the next generation. I absolutely think that taking 2 or 3 minutes to go through that process, while a pain, and no one is saying that your child in any way should be on a flagged list, I think that that's the sort of thing that will catch, that is worth the trouble.
And you, further to that, you talk about not having a registry, but surely an awful lot of gunners, Second Amendment supporters are going to say, look, you already have the information. You've got their name. You've got the social security number. You know they've bought a gun. I mean, that's tantamount to a registry right there. How can you be sure that the government's not going to hold on to any of that information?
Well, again, the devil's in the details. And I think part of what is really important in our state legislature is that we're very, very careful about the way the law is written. And not just the way the law is written, but sometimes we have laws that then leave gray areas for the regulating body to sort of fill in the blanks. And it will be incredibly critical for whatever laws we take on gun safety to be really specific in making sure that we are outlining what those criteria should be and should not.
And then let me ask you further, since the mass shooting at Virginia Beach, Democrats have been very much on the front foot as far as gun control, among other things, calling for a ban on what generally is called assault rifles, really, or semi-automatic rifles. Would you support a ban on assault rifles, given that you've just said you don't want to take anyone's guns, that if you're going to ban them, that's going to become involved at some point?
Yeah, I don't. And I think this is probably an area where the Democratic Party has a wide variety of issues depending on where you are. I think geographically, probably where in Northern Virginia, probably Democrats in Northern Virginia probably have a slightly different view on what gun control or gun safety means versus, you know, down here in Central and Southwest Virginia. I don't. Fully automated machine guns are not outright banned. They are regulated, and I would support higher regulation on semi-automatic weapons. But I think that it doesn't make sense to me to ban something that is less lethal than something that is not banned. I think there is a common sense way to do it. I think that's an area where, I think, again, the devil's in the details, but if we sit down, I think there's a lot of common sense that we can all agree on.
We're speaking with Jennifer Wolfter here on The Morning Show. She's a Democrat running for the 22nd district seat in the House of Delegates. On your website, you decry the amount of money that is in politics these days. And we had in the news this morning that Emily's List, a group that tries to broadly to elect Democratic women, will have its largest ever purchase in Virginia, over $2 million now. Would you pledge not to take money from outside groups like Emily's List as part of this idea of getting the money out of politics?
Yes. So I think it is a huge issue. Virginia as a whole has one of the most lax campaign finance rules for its General Assembly. There is no cap on individual giving. So any individual can come in and pour millions of dollars if they want into a single race. There is no cap on corporate giving. So that means any corporation, whether they're in Virginia or nationally, can pour unlimited amounts of money into the race. And outside groups like political action committees, and other special interest groups. I think that is a huge problem. And I think a lot of people are really disillusioned and apathetic about local politics because of the money. It feels corrupt. And I think there is a question of how well can you advocate for the people that you're representing when you are in the pocket of whoever is your donor. I'm really proud. The vast majority, I think 95% of my money is coming from individual people. We do on our website have a specific, we're not gonna take money from corporations or from special interest groups.
So nothing from Dominion Power, say.
Exactly, and in fact, that's one of the things that I think is most important. And one of the places I would start in terms of campaign ethics reform is prohibiting especially like a full-on ban. You should not be able to take money from the companies, from the regulated monopolies that you are supposed to regulate. You can't regulate people who are paying you. That is a clear conflict of interest. I'm really proud to not be taking their money. I will be clear. No one, they were not offering me money. But that is something that I think is a stark difference between me and my opponent, who in her career has taken more than $50,000 from Dominion Energy and Appalachian Power.
But you, Emily's List, you would accept their money, though, since they're a PAC rather than a corporation?
You know, just like my website says, there would be a limit to it. I think that it's reasonable right now. I think an outright claim to not take any money except for individuals sort of puts you with both hands tied behind your back. I do think, as legally, we should be restricting all of that. But I think my website says $2,500, which right now at the congressional level is sort of where the limits are.
Let's talk a couple of issues with health care here. And something that has come to note recently, we spoke with a rep from the VHHA about it, and which is balance billing or surprise billing, where it happens a lot in emergency rooms. You think you're in network. You may even have checked ahead in some cases if it's not an emergency, and you find out that one doctor is out of network and it's a huge bill. Hospitals blame insurance companies. Insurance companies blame hospitals. How do you fix that?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And I think it goes to a larger issue of just the lack of transparency in billing in our medical system anyway. Last year, I had to have my gallbladder out. It was a planned procedure. I had a couple months to plan for. I spent hours on the phone trying to figure out how much it was going to cost me. The hospital couldn't tell me. The doctor's office couldn't tell me. My insurance company couldn't tell me. The surgeon's office couldn't tell me. And the anesthesiologist. They were all going to send separate bills. Took me hours. I eventually narrowed it down to sort of a ballpark of what I thought it was going to cost. I went in. I had the procedure. If anyone's thinking about having their gallbladder out, I highly recommend it. From the moment I walked in the hospital to the moment I walked out, 5 hours total, including, I would say 90 minutes of that was just filling out the paperwork. It cost $13,000, of which $9,000 my insurance paid for. That's a huge problem. Not being able to know what the price is, the confusion over copays and deductibles. People who have health insurance are afraid to use it because they don't know what the final cost is going to be. But to answer your very specific question about surprise billing, there's a number of things. One is transparency. One of the things I found out after I got my gallbladder out is as part of the pre-op procedure, you have to go get an ultrasound just to make sure all your parts are in the right place. And there's a couple places in town to do it. My doctor's office sent me to their preferred provider, and I went, and it cost $1,000 But what I found out later is there's another place in town that does that exact same procedure for less than a third of the cost. I had no idea. And I think that's an area where if it was easier for people to take a more active role and find out what their options are, I think we could cut the costs a lot right away.
And we just have a moment left. One more question about abortion. During the General Assembly session, Delegate Kathy Tran had an abortion bill, and she was outmaneuvered during a hearing by the Majority Leader Todd Gilbert and said, yes, allow abortion up until essentially the moment of birth. Democrats in this state are much more pro-abortion rights than they have been in the past. Mm-hmm. What regulations, if any, do you think the state of Virginia should put on abortion?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's from a medical perspective, it's a medical procedure. And I think just like all medical procedures, there is absolutely oversight and regulation that needs to be in place to protect the health and well-being of all the parties involved. So I think that just like going in and having your gallbladder removed, there are meaningful requirements and restrictions that should be in place. I do support Roe v. Wade. I think that every pregnancy is different. We will never know the circumstances of any woman's pregnancy. And I believe that those very, very personal decisions should be between a woman and her family and her doctor. And I really don't think politicians in Richmond should be deciding what your doctor is able to do for you.
All right, it's 8:53 here on The Morning Show. Jennifer Wooster, Democrat, running for the 22nd District seat in the House of Delegates. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much.